I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, he's been called America's top cop, and now he's moving on. LAPD Chief William Bratton is retiring. We'll find out what's next for him and for the department in just a few minutes. And we'll find out about an honor for the first African-American elected to the U.S. Senate by popular vote, Edward Brooke. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about education. Throughout the summer and the fall, we've been talking about the major issues and debates in American education. During last year's presidential campaign, both major party candidates agreed that education should be a major priority. Indeed, both agreed with advocacy groups that education should be considered a top civil rights issue. Yesterday, Education Secretary Arne Duncan met with Latino advocacy groups and Spanish language news organizations. NPR's Claudio Sanchez was there, and he joins us now in our studio to talk about it. Claudio, thank you so much for joining us once again.
It's good to be here.
Why did Arne Duncan meet with Latino groups per se?
Latinos had been asking Secretary Duncan to meet with them, only because it seems that education and immigration, I'm not so sure which one is most important to them, but have been the two top issues and concerns about, and certainly they wanted to know more and directly from the secretary about what the administration is going to be doing to address some of the really big issues.
What were some of the reasons they wanted this meeting?
The numbers is what gives this whole issue of Latino education the urgency. In 1993, for example, Latinos accounted for just under 13% of all public school students. By 2008, that was 22%, one out of five. A huge growth, mostly in the South, southeastern United States. Since the mid-1990s, almost all of that growth has been in suburban schools. People think it's rural or urban, but it hasn't. 99% has been driven by Latinos in suburban school systems. South, again, South and southeastern U.S. have been the most dramatic growth. Since 1995, the number of students in U.S. schools who are not native English speakers has shot up 60%. In 20 states, that number has doubled. That's extraordinary. These so-called English language learners, often referred to as ELLs, drop out in huge numbers. A third of all ELL ninth graders do not finish high school. These are all government figures.
So goes the achievement of Latino students, so goes the achievement of a huge number of American students overall.
Precisely. Remember that the projections for 20, 25 years down the road is that at some point, Latinos are going to constitute half of the U.S. school-age population. That's already happened in many school districts like Texas and California.
So what was Arne Duncan's message at this meeting?
Well, Mr. Duncan essentially gave a pretty package speech, one that people have heard before, citing certainly what the administration is doing with its money, a lot of money these days. He threw out an interesting figure. He said that back in 2000, Secretary Rod Page under the Bush administration had about $17 million to spend on so-called innovation and money to prod states and districts to do something different, something better. He has $10 billion. I mean, that tells you everything about what this administration thinks it can do. The frustration with the folks in the crowd, certainly in the Latino community in general, is that you haven't really told us what you're going to do with that money. And they cite the fact that early childhood education, for example, which is so crucial to the Latino community, has yet to see any of that money. And, Secretary Duncan has kept saying, wait, be patient, we're going to start doing these things. I think that a lot of what Mr. Duncan faces, the dilemma, is that so little of this really has been debated in the Congress because the Congress is preoccupied with so much, certainly the war and health care.
One of the ongoing debates in education, as you know and as you've talked to us about, is what's most important in student achievement? Is it the parents and what's happening at home, or is it what's happening at school? Here, Arne Duncan was asked, how do you encourage Latino families to stress the importance of education? And let's just play a short clip and see what he had to say.
It's really making schools community centers. It's engaging families. And what I saw when we opened the doors, when we meet students and parents halfway, they respond. They're successful. When we meet families halfway, when we give them opportunity, our students can do extraordinarily well.
What's he saying?
A lot of this, again, is packaged. It's things that he said before. The only thing that I guess people should read into this is that he's talking from his Chicago experience. Mr. Duncan did reach out to the Latino community. It was a very mixed record, according to people I've talked to, because for every child that he may have reached, there were at least 5, 10, maybe even 50 kids who were not reached. These are kids who are still struggling, who are still dropping out of high school, who are still clearly not on a path to making it beyond high school. And that's the source of the frustration, that we hear Mr. Duncan talk about community schools, for example, but how many community schools did he create really in Chicago, or how many are in a position to create those kinds of extended services to families that engage and bring parents in to stress the importance of
education. When you say the source of the frustration, was there frustration at the meeting? Did you have a sense that these groups are getting impatient with his efforts?
There sure was. And, you know, I was able to talk to Ana Solis Gutierrez, a former school board member in Montgomery County.
Maryland, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C., a quite affluent suburb of Washington, D.C.
Precisely, but where Latino achievement is actually pretty low. Some parents in Montgomery County, again, a wealthy county, complain that, you know, their kids are warehoused, essentially, that there aren't nearly enough programs or teachers who can deal with them. And now that Solis Gutierrez is a delegate from Montgomery County to the Maryland State House, she has brought some of these things forth. And she was at the event precisely to kind of truth squad Mr. Duncan and said something that I think most people felt.
Okay, this is what she had to say. Here it is.
I've heard his speech now 4 times, and it's the same thing. I mean, it's very innovative and good, but he doesn't get us. He doesn't get the issues of the Hispanic population. There is no targeting of ELL.
And there, when she says there's no targeting of ELL, she's talking about English language learners, the money that the federal government now has to address issues of immigrant kids, ELL, those kinds of things is still sitting there for the most part. Very few schools are seeing any results.
So, Claudia, where does this conversation go from here?
Well, I think the one big issue here that we haven't talked about is immigration. And immigration is inextricably tied to this question of education. The Latino community expects the Obama administration to tackle this head on and to put forth some of the, most controversial proposals like amnesty and so forth. But many folks that I've talked to in the Latino community point out that unless he addresses that first, this whole question of education really is going to go unaddressed because so much of the demographic growth, the explosive growth of the Latino population does come from immigration. Not all, clearly. But unless that is resolved, there's going to be this feeling, and there is this feeling, that education issues are going to continue. I mean, there's a revolving door. For every one kid that you do succeed with, there's 5 more that are entering this country or born of Latino immigrant parents, many of them undocumented, that come to school, again, totally unprepared to learn. And there's this sense that the more we fix, the more we see the problem grow.
NPR education correspondent Claudio Sanchez was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Claudio, thank you for joining us. Keep us posted.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Across the country today, more than 300 schools in 19 states were closed because of H1N1 outbreaks. NPR's David Shaper reports from one high school in the Chicago suburb of St. Charles.
You'd expect a high school to be quite a lively place on a Friday afternoon, especially with a big crosstown rivalry football game that had been scheduled for tonight. But all is quiet here at St. Charles East, where the school has been closed since Wednesday. Superintendent Don Schloman says problems began Monday morning when more than 600 students stayed home sick. Throughout the day, he says scores more were sent home.
And by the end of Tuesday, we were at 972 absences at the school, so nearly closing in on 1,000. So in math terms, the slope was not a positive one for us.
That's 45% of the 2,200 students at St. Charles East out sick. So with projects coming due and big exams scheduled, and contrary to the advice from the county health department, Schloman decided to shut down East for the remainder of the week.
As I told somebody, they don't teach you those decisions as superintendent of school.
St. Charles East is the only school in the area that had to close. Schloman thinks it might be related to homecoming activities last week.
They were together every day pretty much in some sort of pep assembly, or they had a volleyball games or whatever. Add on to that a student dance with 1,400 students in a gymnasium, and you have a lot of capacity to transmit germs very easily.
Schloman says only about a third of students still reported feeling sick yesterday, and he suspects the number has dropped again today. So classes will resume Monday. Extracurricular activities resume this weekend, including that football game against rival St. Charles North. And swine flu vaccines have arrived and will be available here Monday. David Shaper, NPR News in St. Charles, Illinois.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. The NBA season starts tonight, and if past is prologue, the season will feature an incident or two of a player or coach behaving immaturely. Well, here's a story about a man who spent his career in the NBA and then decided it was time to cavort with the legitimately immature, the under-10 set. NPR's Mike Pesca has his story.
I want you to go on this turn over here and go spot the track. Go. A fifth grader right around 11 a.m. has such a need for movement, such a jumping Jack Jones, that a clever teacher...
Two factors of 30.
...can actually sneak in a little math lesson while no one's looking.
Five and six.
Joe Carbone is the gym teacher at a small New York charter school called TEP, The Equity Project. TEP is based in Manhattan's Washington Heights. They actually share a field with the high school where Manny Ramirez played baseball. The difference is Ramirez is merely childlike. Joe Carbone's nine-year-olds are surprised when asked to run farther than many have ever run before.
Four laps around? Tomorrow, we're going to do four laps. Today?
Yeah, that's a mile!
Today we're
Carbone is TEP's only teacher with no prior classroom experience. His journey is as meandering as the route some of the fifth graders have adopted on their way around the track. Up until 2008, Carbone was the strength coach for the Los Angeles Lakers, a job he took at the behest of his sole client from the mid-90s until 2004, Kobe Bryant.
Once you've done it, it's an amazing career. Me personally, I think it's for someone who is maybe married without kids or maybe not married.
Zeke Vanderhook, the founder and principal of TEP, saw the resume from an NBA MVP's personal trainer and was intrigued.
There's no reason why those fifth graders don't deserve as great physical education trainer as elite athletes.
Of course, in a capitalist society, what one deserves usually takes a backseat to what one can afford. And this is the second remarkable thing about Joe Carbone and every other teacher at TEP. They all make $125,000 a year. Vanderhook, sitting in the Soho offices of his for-profit test prep company, explains that paying for top talent works for the rest of our society, so why not teachers?
If you actually invest in them, as opposed to simply saying that they're important, but just paying lip service to it, not really investing in them, we think it's very cost-effective.
The high salary was necessary to attract Carbone. He says if an NBA strength coach hustles and leverages his affiliation, he can make much more, but on straight salary, $125,000 is pretty competitive. Carbone wanted TEP, but there were some questions to answer before it was clear TEP could use him. So I asked Carbone about the possibility of teaching a 10-year-old who might be averse to any non-Xbox exercise. Are you confident that you'll be able to reach the really clumsy and unathletic kid considering, you know, you came from dealing with NBA superstars?
I love working with the clumsier kids because they really need it more than anybody for their confidence, and I'll spend extra time with those kids.
Vanderhook saw just that when he observed Carbone in a school setting. Carbone was engaged, and by the end, so was every member of the gym class. And while Laker fans may bemoan the fact that they've lost an expert at dealing with the impetuous and easily distracted, just as they've signed Ron Artest, it seems the TEP students are benefiting. Carbone is learning, too. Early in the day, he was assigning a third of his class to be spotters at far-flung points along the track. After a few periods, he recalibrated.
In the first classes, you were telling kids to go to the cones just to get them involved, but then I think you realized, well, they're a quarter mile away.
Yeah, too far, man. Yeah, and that's like you learn logistics every day, you know? So you try to make each class a little bit better.
Most of the students know that Carbone worked with Kobe Bryant. That buys about 4 seconds of respect from a child. At this level, providing expert oversight of a rousing game of sharks versus minnows is a lot more impressive than a championship ring. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
Bring it in. Game over. Bring it in right here. Bring it in. Bring it in right.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Today in Your Health, we have the second of two reports about mental health problems on campus. The number of students seeking psychiatric help is on the rise. That's true from small community colleges to elite universities. Last week, we told you about the problem. Today, NPR's Deborah Franklin tells us what some schools are doing about it.
A new crop of freshmen arrived on the Stanford University campus in California last month. It was a blue sky day as they stood in line outside the dorms waiting for room assignments from the student resident assistants.
Just got your name tag and all that jazz, P.O. box key, and this little packet.
Looking on, Stanford residence dean, Arcadio Morales. He and his family have an apartment in the dorms, and he's helped usher in every new class for 15 years. In a quieter moment, Morales told us that there have always been some students who pack emotional baggage along with their laptops and books, but the mix of problems he sees have changed.
Early on, most of the issues that surface were roommate issues, sort of compatibility issues.
He still gets that stuff, along with anxiety over midterms. But these days, Morales is seeing some more serious mental health issues, too.
We're getting students that wouldn't have been here 10 years ago because they're on antidepressants or antipsychotic medication, and they're functioning, you know, fairly well.
but it can be a big challenge for the colleges when these students have crises, which has been happening more often at Stanford and other schools. Those middle-of-the-night calls are very hard for any school and any student.
I was just going through a depression, but it was a depression that was getting worse and worse.
Amanda Gellander, now a Stanford senior, has bipolar disorder with symptoms that are mostly evened out with medication. But that night in the dorm 2 years ago, the bottom fell out, and she called a family member.
I was in hysterical tears. I was making remarks, you know, what's the point? You know, just things that a depressed person would say. Just very, I was really sad.
But not suicidal, she says. She just needed to vent. After that, Amanda hung up the phone and went to sleep. She had no idea her family was worried enough to call 911.
And about an hour later, there's banging on my door. I go to the door. There's two armed police who barge in, and they're talking about, you know, where are your pills? Where are your pills? And they start ransacking through my entire room. They're opening drawers. They're going through my shelves. And I'm half naked. I'm dressed for bed. And, you know, they're like, are you going to kill yourself? Are you going to kill yourself? I'm just like, no, I'm not going to kill myself. And they're threatening to take me to the psych ward. And they've got their handcuffs in their hands. And I don't know what you say to convince someone that you're not going to kill yourself besides, no, I'm not going to kill myself.
The police phoned the psychiatrist on call, and after some back and forth, they left. But the whole experience left Amanda horribly shaken. She understands the police have been asked to deal with suicide threats this way. It's protocol. She doesn't blame her family. They just wanted to keep her safe.
But that's the option that loved ones have. If they fear for someone, they have to call the police.
Of course, figuring out on the spot who's a risk to themselves and who's not isn't easy for anyone. Stanford's Arcadio Morales helps train student residence assistants in the dorms.
And I always tell the RAs, better to have someone angry and alive than dead and dead.
Everyone agrees it's much better to get help for a troubled student before they're in crisis. All across the U.S., concerned colleges, students, and parents are trying to do just that. Amanda Gellander started a theater project to bring mental illness into the light. And down the street from Stanford, a former Palo Alto mayor and his wife, Vic and Mary Ojakian, became mental health advocates after their son Adam died by suicide at the University of California, Davis, in 2004.
We determined that he became very anxious due to a certain situation, what's called a triggering event, and it was ultimately severe depression that caused his death.
Mary Ojakian and her husband didn't know their son was depressed. He never talked about it. But after Adam died, they interviewed his friends, people in the counseling center, police, professors, even the chancellor. And that's when they learned about the shortage of therapists on college campuses and about how little training most faculty and even police get in how to recognize and handle mentally ill students.
We realized, and they realized, that there was a lot that could be done to change the situation on campus.
The whole situation just makes Vic Ojakian angry.
Guess what? What's going on right now isn't acceptable. We took a look at our situation and we said to ourselves, we don't want another good human being dying. And we decided to do something about that, not to sit back, not to do another study. We decided we were going to go save lives.
Yeah, someone's got to draw the line.
Someone else has drawn the line, or tried to. The International Association of Counseling Services recommends that in order to keep students safe and healthy, a college campus should have a minimum of one therapist for every 1,000 to 1,500 students. When you fall short of that, and many colleges do, the wait lists for students seeking help can get very, very long. And research shows that students who get stuck on these wait lists are more likely to drop out of school. Vic Ojakian.
When you have an illness, most of us want to be treated immediately. If you break your arm, you don't want somebody saying you're going to have to wait 2 to 6 weeks.
But that's the sort of wait time Stanford students faced last year until the university hired 6 more therapists. At the same time, it introduced a new system to triage phone calls so that the neediest students could get in to see a counselor right away. The university hired psychiatrist Dr. Ron Albuquer to head the counseling center.
It was a pretty intense trial by fire when I first got here. There were quite a few things going on at the same time.
Psychiatric hospitalizations were up. So were the number of students who needed medication as well as therapy. And most students who want or need long-term counseling still have to be referred to therapists off campus.
Because even with that many counselors, we're still incredibly busy.
When Stanford's endowment took a big hit last year and the school had to slash its budget, it chose not to lay off therapists. It did add a new fee for all students, about $500 a year, with most of that money going to mental health services. Daniel Eisenberg is a mental health researcher at the University of Michigan. He says in these very tight financial times, some other universities and colleges are making tough choices.
College campuses see their central mission as being education, and so I think there's sometimes a question about whether mental health services really fits into that central mission.
Vic and Mary Ojakian, whose son died in the midst of a deep depression, think society doesn't have a choice. Some big fixes will cost big money, and they think it's a good investment given the statistics. Half of all cases of mental illness first show up in the early teen years, and 75% by age 24. Vic Ojakian says college is prime time to intervene and get these young adults on a healthy path. He also has ideas for high school seniors and their parents.
For parents, they need to look at a college not just in terms of its academic credentials. They need to make sure that the mental health service they provide on campus, they need to get an idea of what they're doing and how well they're doing it.
Asking about the number of counselors and what services they have for students after hours. That's just a start, he says. Some other mental health tools are just as important and cheap enough that even financially strapped colleges should have them in place.
How do they communicate their services? Because that's a critical thing. You know, how do they use their web, some of these social networking tools? Do campuses have peer support groups?
Amanda Gellander, who was so depressed 2 years ago, says support from friends, family, and her doctor, along with a change in her medication, were all crucial to helping her get back on track.
Now, every day's a struggle, but I have more hope. I'm applying to a lot of postgraduate programs. I'm actually excited about my future.
Bipolar disorder is still a part of her, Amanda says, but it doesn't define her. Deborah Franklin, NPR News.